Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mike DeCourcy talking college hoops with Mully and Haw. The Sporting News, Big Ten Network. He's a Liverpool supporter, but we let him on the show anyway. Mike DeCourcy on 670 The Score.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. It's always a delight to talk to Mike DeCourcy. He joins us on the St. Charles Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram Hotline, home of $7,000 off on Jeeps. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm ruining my bracket already. I just started. I did like my what would you call it? Just sort of my first impression bracket.
By the gut.
Disaster. Yeah. Absolute disaster.
It's amazing how it's a disaster and no one's played yet.
How could I blow up my bracket myself, Mike?
That's knowing yourself, Mike.
That is something.
Well, it seemed like they got it right. I think the biggest surprise for me is there's not like a ton of complaints. There's usually people, you know, getting on a table and yelling about something. It seems like most of the experts predicted this fairly close to what happened.
I think they did a terrible job.
Thank God.
I will say this. First of all, some of the regions, there's so little life in them that it's that you need like a vampire to roll through to liven them up. I mean, the region in which Virginia is, the South region, it's almost like it was concocted over the Bennett family table. I mean,
how good the matchups are for Virginia potentially.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean, there's just, like, you look at it, and there is not a, other than their own DeAndre Hunter, there is not a single projected lottery pick in the entire region. The first rounders that I looked at, ESPN's Jonathan Givony, a good friend of mine, respect his work a lot. In his mock bracket, most recent mock draft, the closest thing he has to a first-round pick are Eric Pascoe and Grant Williams, who are veteran guys who might go 26th or 27th. I mean, I was amazed when I looked at it. And there's no teams in there that are like, okay, we're going to make these guys move. No one's going to speed them up. It's all teams like Wisconsin that, yeah, we'll play your pace. Sure. Okay. I was really amazed by that, but there is nothing that I can't remember them ever doing anything as egregiously wrong. And I don't want to use any pejoratives to suggest lack of intelligence, but how do you possibly defend putting Michigan State in Duke's region? How can you listen to what their rationale on this is, okay? If you get out MapQuest, and they have this kind of thing that's like MapQuest on their bracketing tool, okay? Mm-hmm. You get out MapQuest, you put in East Lansing to D.C., it's like 591 miles. You put in East Lansing to Kansas City, and it's like 710. So for 120 miles, they put the number 6 overall team in with the number 1 overall team for 120 miles. I mean, can you explain that to me? How you're supposed to believe as an intelligent, thinking adult that 120 miles is going to make the difference for the people at Michigan State over one being in their natural region, which, hey, newsflash, is the Midwest. Michigan has been a Midwestern state pretty much my entire lifetime. I don't think it's moved. And two, the fact that they have to play now to get to the Final Four, the number one team in their own bracket or in the committee's own judgment, and I think pretty much everyone else's, the number one team in Duke, which has by far the number one player, which has two first-team All-Americans, which has four potential lottery picks, come on, guys, it's not that hard.
They would have been better off losing, Mike. They would have been better off going west with having lost to Michigan because of what you just described. And the argument will be that this is what the fans wanted. They wanted, you know, they looking at this, you know, geography and using that argument, but.
820 miles, Dave. It's not
even
500.
I'm with you. But I just think that they diminish the value of the Big Ten tournament. These conference tournaments no longer are viewed. You look at the way Cincinnati was seeded as well for winning theirs. It just doesn't seem like it's worth it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems lazy. Like, oh, gosh, you know, we don't want to have to work too hard. And then they always hide behind the defense that, well, we spent so much time on making sure we got the right teams. Here's the truth. There is no right answer at the edge of the bubble. There's just the answer you pick. Indiana, Belmont, Temple, they're all not good. Or not great, I guess I should say. They're all good. They're not great. So there's no correct answer in that. I mean, they did fine. There's nothing wrong with who they picked. And if they put Indiana and NC State in there, there would have been nothing wrong with who they picked. So why do you not get the bracket right? And again, this is not hard. This is not calculus, which I never took because it's calculus. It's not that hard. 120 miles means nothing to anybody. But Duke versus North Carolina means a ton. There are teams there's at least one team in the Big Ten that's beaten Carolina. There's nobody in the Big Ten that has beaten Duke. And there's only two teams that have beaten Duke at full strength, which is what you have now. If there were no Zion, they wouldn't be in D.C. They would be somewhere else. They would not be the overall number one. He makes them the best team in the country. He showed that over the weekend with what he accomplished. And now you're saying to Michigan State, here's what you have to do because of 120 miles. I mean, I can't believe a group of intelligent thinking people sat there in that room and said that 120 miles matters that much.
How good is Ja Morant, and can he take that team on his back anywhere?
He's very special. He really a big point guard, 6'4", 6'5", long, dynamic, very capable shooter. He's not one of the elite shooters, but he can make a three and stretch you out. It'll be very interesting to see maybe the best player matchup in the entire first round. Which is, you know, not two good players on the same floor, but two great players who will be playing more or less against one another. Point guard Marcus Howard for Marquette and point guard Ja Morant for Murray State. Really exciting to see that. I don't know whether or not either will want the other to have to guard his opposite, but they'll be facing each other a lot. And Marcus is a really creative, inventive scorer. I think the most, most inventive scorer in the entire tournament. And of course, Ja is a big time prospect. So that'll be very exciting when they get together.
Mike, you point out correctly the lack of sizzle in some of these regions of the matchups, but one that does have a little bit of intrigue certainly is Louisville and Minnesota. Richard Pitino in Minnesota going up against Rick Pitino's old team, Louisville's being sued by Rick Pitino. I don't think that's the kind of attention, though, you're talking about the NCAA selection committee wanted to generate before one of those games.
I talked about that in my region breakdowns, and you can find my breakdowns of each of the four regions on TSN Mike on Twitter. I talked about that. Another thing that you can't believe that they said, okay, we're good with that. You know, when you're doing those bracketing exercises, I mean, things like that pop up and people think that you're doing it to create attention. But do you really want this attention?
No.
Where people are talking about the trials and talking about the FBI and all that because this comes up. Don't just say in that room, let's get that one down. We don't want that. This is not what we want the tournament to be about. And again, because they pay so little attention to whether it's the fair game, I'm sure you can't take it down for that. You know, you can't say, well, no, it would be affecting the integrity of the tournament. The fairness of the tournament went out as soon as they concerned themselves with 120 miles. So you can get rid of that matchup. I think that was really another poor idea from the committee. I will tell you guys that the bracket reaction every year that happens is completely unknown to me because as soon as I get done at BTN on Sunday night, I get in a cab or I get wherever I happen to be, and I go get to my hotel room, and then I am like, it's me and my computer for the next 5 hours. And I wrote 5,000 words in the next 5 hours last night. So I have no idea what anybody said. And I am astonished to hear from you guys that no one is having the problems with the committee that I am, because I think this is among the poorer jobs they've ever done.
I'm delighted to hear you say it, honestly, because everybody's kind of, well, these are the teams everyone picked, and there's no real surprises. And I think we talked to Jerry Palm. He had one team out instead of, you know, they got
Belmont
all
was
the
only
teams
one
right.
he had wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Belmont was the only one he had wrong.
But, Mike, I would think that that's accurate. There seems to be a consensus that the committee did a fairly good job. There wasn't a whole lot of backlash on television. And I think you're entitled to your opinion because it's a strong one and it's defensible. But I think overall, yeah, it would say the committee came out of this year with probably less controversy than in past years.
Very disappointed to hear that, because it tells me that their heads are in as wrong a position as the committee's is. The committee has been doing this thing with geography for at least a decade. I can't remember what year it was that I first went there and did the mock bracket exercise, and they showed us that tool. And I'm like, what? Why does this matter? Why does anybody care about being on a plane for 15 more minutes than otherwise? I mean, it's like a half an hour difference in plane ride from East Lansing to Kansas City or East Lansing to D.C. If you look at it, it's about the same, depending on the flight. It's within $100. Again, 120 miles, $100, that seems to be the number of the day. Michigan, if you're a Michigan fan in East Lansing, and there are a few of those, and you want to go out to Anaheim to see the Wolverines next weekend if they make it, it's going to cost you about $100 more than it'll cost you to go to D.C. unless you get really lucky with your plane flight. And then you might be able to save a couple $100. I mean, it's just not that much. And yet they act like that is what this is about. This is not about how long you travel. It is about who you play. If you talk to every coach that is in this tournament, there are 68 this morning, every coach will say one thing. The tournament is about matchups. So why do we pay so little attention to the matchups and so much attention to something as picayune as 120 miles?
Mike, who's your final four?
Well, you have to. My first team obviously is Duke. No one's beaten them, or very few teams have beaten them at full strength. And I don't. Although I really like the Wolverines, they're not at full strength now. They lost another player yesterday in Kyle Arnes, I don't see that happening. So I think Duke from there. From the West, I picked Michigan. I really like Gonzaga, but I think Xavier Simpson's ability to control a game, if they get to the Gonzaga game, I think they win it. I picked Virginia because, as I said, I just don't see anybody in that region who is built to beat them. The only way they lose that game is if they beat these four games, is if they beat themselves. And then from the Midwest, I don't see anybody to threaten Kentucky or Carolina, so I think they play each other. The first time they played, I know Carolina wasn't as good then, but Kentucky wasn't as good then either. Kentucky handled them pretty easily. I think Kentucky will have learned the last lesson they needed to learn with how they kind of blew the Tennessee game, and perhaps that'll get them through that matchup. So that's my final four. Kentucky would be the out of the Midwest.
All righty, Mike. Thanks a ton.
Thanks, Mike. Strong stuff.
Thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Good stuff.
Yeah, that's wow. I mean, I'm delighted to hear that.
Well, if you got an opinion that strong, you need to defend it, and he did. He made a lot of sense. His point should be about the matchup. It shouldn't be about geography or the fans or the easiest venue to get to.
But the problem is when you start looking at these mock drafts and stuff, there are players on teams that aren't in the tournament. I mean, there's Romeo Langford from Indiana and Darius Garland from Vanderbilt. There are guys that are going to go high in the NBA draft that didn't make the tournament. So it's hard to kind of pick apart the lottery picks. Who's the kid from France the guy who plays in France? There's an international. It's hard to kind of line it up. Duke's got three of them, So that bracket's going to be loaded with NBA talent.
Yeah.
It's just a difficult case to make, that's all. But I hear what he's saying. I think Tennessee's a pretty good team.
Tennessee's a very good team.
We'll see.
But the committee chairman, Bernard Muir, made a mistake by just being as specific as he was in explaining why MSU's in the East region because Washington, D.C. is 590 miles away from East Lansing.
That's a great point.
And Kansas City is 705.
All right. We're going to take a quick moment. We're going to we'll get back into some of this conversation. We got a bunch of stuff to talk about, and we're going to talk a little Blackhawks in a bit here with Steve Conroy. Did you see Joel Quenneville came out?
Yeah, he did.
And talked. We
haven't
heard from
Joel.
So, we'll get into that with him in a little bit. We got a lot for you. It's Mully and Haw on the Score.
Been a one seed, been a seven seed, got to a Final Four as a seven, got beat the first weekend as a one. I don't know that much about Bradley. I'll know a lot more by the end of tonight. But I'm not going to let anybody talk me into talking about that. If you want the truth, I'm going to enjoy this incredible, incredible win by the players in that locker room. And to be honest with you, every player that ever played here. I think everybody took great solace in this win.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 to the Score. That's Tom Izzo. He, of course, the Michigan State head coach, and Sparty beat the Wolverines yet again three times. And boy, the Michigan State players will love that. The Michigan State fans will love that.
It was a great day for the
rivalry.
Spartans.
Sure.
You had a really ugly incident. Kyle Arns goes down with a bad ankle injury.
Bad looking.
You wanted to look away, and it was scary to see them take him off the court as they did. They win that game, and then they get rewarded with more of a sentence. They were sentenced to be in the same bracket as Duke, in the same region as Duke. And you win the Big Ten championship, and you think that that's going to be enough to either, A, be a number one seed, which I think they deserve more than Gonzaga did, or B, be put in a situation where you're not on a collision course with the best team in the tournament. You're the sixth best overall team according to the rankings of Michigan State. And now you're looking squarely at Duke in the Elite Eight.
All right, but
that doesn't seem right.
Okay, and that's fair. That's a fair assessment of where they're at. But they're not a number one seed. They didn't do enough to earn the number one seed.
Did Gonzaga?
They weren't even in the conversation. Tennessee was supposed to be the number one seed, the fourth number one seed, and instead it goes to the
Zags. They were in the conversation. I mean, that's the debate then. If Tennessee had done more in their conference tournament, then you're weighing Tennessee versus Michigan State. Michigan State had 12 victories against quad one teams.
Yeah, I understand what they've done. I'm just telling you that when you heard the explanation as to why they were chosen the way they were, it turned out that they weren't. It didn't even matter. It didn't matter when they played the Big Ten championship. It didn't matter that they won it as late as they did. It just wasn't anything that they were taking into account. So, I mean, I understand the frustration with that, but it didn't matter to the committee, and they weren't going to be a number one seed. So they end up obviously against a really strong Duke team, and it's a collision course. But if you're going to win the tournament, you're going to have to beat them anyway. So the problem is you'd have to beat them to get to the Final Four. That's you know, an Elite Eight run is nothing to
no, it's not. But why does seeding matter? Why do we make such a big deal about ones and twos? And where seeding matters because you're trying to align yourself in the best possible way to get to the Final Four, which is an accomplishment in itself. Nobody who goes to the Final Four, I shouldn't say that. In most cases, getting to the Final Four marks a successful season anyway. If Michigan State gets to the Final Four, that's a sense of accomplishment for this team, right?
Yes, it is.
But they're not looking like that's as much of a possibility. It's harder to do now because of the way that they were rewarded for winning the Big Ten championship.
But,
and that, I just think it minimizes.
Totally, I understand your argument, but isn't Tom Izzo, doesn't he measure his program by championships, not just Final Four trips?
Yeah.
I mean, he's reached that level as a coach.
So you're saying you have to beat Duke anyway. What difference does it make if it's the Elite Eight or the Final Four in the championship
maybe
game?
Maybe they're ripe for an upset by then. Maybe they're gone already. That's not true.
Well, you never know.
The problem in evaluating Duke, and it's a problem, you know, when you are looking for teams and when you are looking for – they've got a couple things that you love. NBA talent. They got NBA talent. They got three guys that will be drafted in the lottery, okay? They got three of the top five picks in the draft I mean,
potentially.
Yeah.
RJ Barrett, Cam Reddish, and
yes,
Zion.
And Zion, yeah, the number one overall pick. The guy will be taken first. So you look at that and you say, good God, look at the NBA talent. They, you know, the three-pointer, it's a really interesting thing when you start breaking down teams that can shoot the three, because I think we look at it and we say, well, you have to be able to shoot the three to win in the tournament. But if all you do is shoot the three, then you're not going to win the NCAA tournament. It's a really – you live by the three and you die by the three, but you've got to have that in your hip pocket. And I don't think Duke does. I think that they could run into a game where they don't knock down their shots, where they don't hit their threes. Despite all their NBA talent,
right,
they're young players, first of all. They're all freshmen.
They're 19-year-old kids.
And they're 19-year-old yeah. kids, and they get a cold shooting night, and maybe they run into a problem. So, you know, I don't think they're perfect.
They're
but
not.
They're obviously loaded with talent.
But what and you're
the,
saying
there's
and
a
suggesting
reason they're the number one team.
Is possible, but it would be historic because it would be the biggest upset of this tournament. If Duke goes down the way you say they go down.
I don't know. If Duke loses to a number two seed, if Duke loses to Michigan State, is that really the most surprising? You know, this is not a 16 against a 1. This would be, you know, an elite –
okay,
game.
But I think when you look at Duke, I see, as we talked about earlier, this is the year in college basketball of Zion Williamson. This is the year where you're going to remember his freshman year, his only year as a college yeah. basketball player, much like Carmelo Anthony in 2003, Anthony Davis in 2012. I think this is the year where Duke rides Zion to a title. And if that doesn't happen, you're going to remember this is the year that Zion didn't win as much as you will as whoever beats Duke because they can't shoot the three. So I think them as the heavy favorite in this tournament makes everything we're talking about, valid. But if you're put in a position in a bracket like Michigan State and you're looking at them a bracket where you meet them in the Elite Eight, you're like you're getting that. You're like, oh my gosh, because they are such the heavy favorite. They're the team that everyone dreads facing most.
But David, I mean, look, I mean they're loaded with talent, and I'm not saying they're not. But they're not a perfect team, and I think and I agree that they're intimidating because of their athletic ability. But there's a lot of really good teams in college basketball, and there are a lot of kind of teams that can pull off a shocker here or there. Duke is not a perfect team. And we've seen plenty of great college players that fell on their face in the NCAA tournament, right? I mean,
oh yeah,
Michael Jordan won a championship as a freshman, and that was his only championship. He hit a shot to win a championship, and Georgetown had to turn the ball over after that. But the fact is, we've seen a ton of great players come through and not win a championship. Jordan ended up being the greatest player in the history of basketball, and a lot of arguments, you know, obviously people like LeBron, he didn't even go to college, but it doesn't just because you're a great college talent doesn't mean you're going to win a title, especially when you're not the guy controlling the ball. The one game I really want to watch is the Murray State game, because I want to see this kid from an NBA standpoint. I want to see what this kid can do that makes me want the Bulls to draft him. You see what I'm saying? Because I don't think they're going to get Zion Williamson. I don't think they're going to be in a position to do it. I think they're going to need a point guard.
Well, as crazy as it
sounds, Murray State against Marquette seems like a great matchup.
Yeah, it's going to be a great matchup. I would never, you know, want this to happen if you're a Bulls fan. But if you end up with Ja Morant rather than Zion Williamson in the draft, you're not going to be complaining that long, I think, because he's probably a better fit.
He fits the need
of the Bull for the Bulls right now.
And that's why
that's crazy to say, but
I want to see what he does in the big moment on the big stage. He's outmanned. He's playing a team that has more talent than his team.
When you watch
him
play, and I've only seen him a couple games, and you never know about the opponent and the competition level, he looks like a little Westbrook. He looks like a guy that can take over athletically in the way that Russell Westbrook takes over games.
It's also interesting because Marquette down the stretch, they really seemed to struggle, and they were turning the ball over a lot. So what kind of havoc he can cause on defense will be fun.
It's always nice back here in front of family and some friends. And, you know, I grew up a big Habs fan when I was younger. So, you know, it's always exciting to come back and play in this building.
Mullion Hall! Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. We are delighted to welcome in Steve Conroy, the color analyst on both WGN and NBC Sports of Chicago Blackhawks. And he joins us on the St. Charles Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram Hotline, home of $7,000 off on Jeeps. And Steve, we just heard there from Corey Crawford talking about being in Montreal, where he grew up, a fan of the team, and what a joy it is for him to have 48 saves, another shutout, a fantastic performance, always good in Montreal. Were you like that with Toronto, Steve? Is that
Well, I wish I was. It's funny. I think I did play well. I don't think I ever put up huge numbers when I was in Toronto, a town that I grew up in. But, you always play well because you realize not only are mom and dad there, but, you've got your family, your immediate family, tons of friends. And I think with Corey, the other thing that drives him in Montreal is the guy down at the other end, Carey Price. And, we kind of talked about it during the telecast, is that Carey Price gets all this press as being, maybe the best goalie in the NHL for the last, 10 years. And he does not have Stanley Cups. And Corey Crawford, of course, has a couple of those on his resume. He does have Vezinas. Corey doesn't. And like I said, he gets all the accolades. He gets all the praise. But I think that drives Corey. So, yeah, the fact that he was a huge Patrick Waugh fan growing up, and, it's his hometown. Chateauguay is literally 15 minutes from downtown Montreal. I think that's inspiration for him. So I was at the morning skate that Saturday morning, and mom and dad were in the stands, and he had about 10 other people there too. So you certainly don't want to let down, those people when you're performing at night.
I don't think he's lost there, Steve. I think that's the statistic that was really remarkable. He rises to the occasion when he goes back home. Only the 18th goalie in NHL history, I believe, to have 48 saves. Only in his seventh start back from the concussion and his second shutout. Steve, when you look at what he's doing well and how at the level he's playing at, how do you attribute the fact that he's been able to do this quickly? How unexpected has it been for you to watch?
Well, David, that's a great question. You know what I think? He's a cerebral goalie. He really thinks the game. And, I mean, I think, sometimes you say that about a lot of athletes, whether it's Tom Brady and as a quarterback. But I think he understands the game so well. And, it's funny. Excuse me. When he was growing up in Montreal, up until the age of 11, he was a forward. So he knows how the game works from the other side of the puck. And I think that really helps him in his reads. He just anticipates so well. And, he's got great focus. And of course he was a little more focused being back home in Montreal. But I just think the way he can anticipate the game, a lot of times you see these stops he makes, he's square, he's ready for the puck to come to him. And a lot of times it's just hitting him. And that's what being a goaltender is all about, is making yourself big and making the stop. So, I think the fact that, he's a real student of the game, and him and Jimmy Waite, the goaltending coach for the Blackhawks, have a great relationship. They've got, great scouting reports on all the shooters and all the scorers from other teams. But he takes it to another level with his preparation. And I just think the fact that he knows what's going to happen. It's almost like Patrick Kane. He knows what's going to happen a second before it actually happens. So I think that's a huge advantage for him.
The Hawks have won five in a row, and it's interesting to look at the playoff picture and try to figure out if they're going to run out of time or if they can get this done. They obviously have a game in hand, but it's just a lot of work. You need help at this point of the year.
Yeah, I had a pilot friend of mine tell me a few days ago they're running out of runway.
And I think well put.
You're absolutely right, because, listen, they're playing great right now. They do have a game in hand. They've got two winnable games coming up in Vancouver and Philadelphia. And, those – after that, though, they play Colorado next weekend back-to-back. And I think that'll be the that'll tell them whether or not they've got a legitimate chance or not, because if they lose one of those two games – I don't really like their chances. And then it finishes. Listen how it finishes. They play, and this is at home, though. They play Winnipeg, St. Louis, Dallas, all at home. Then they have to go into Nashville. So those are their last four games. So that's going to be tough. And then, you know, throw in a West Coast trip to Arizona, San Jose, and L.A., and that's the 11 games right there. So it ain't going to be easy. And I think the team knows that, but I think they view it as a challenge now. And if you know anything about the character of some of these guys, whether it's Jonathan Toews or Patrick Kane or Duncan Keith, Brent Seabrook, they're up for challenges. And I think that would be a great story if they could do this when they were literally the last place team in the NHL, I think sometime in January. If they could do this, it would be quite a story. So I think that's what's driving them. It's going to be very difficult. You know, I don't know what the odds. There's a couple of websites out there that put actual fractions or percentages on what the chances of a team winning are. And I know the Blackhawks just a couple of weeks ago were 1.9%, but that was before the five-game winning streak. So who knows? It's doable, but it's going to be pretty tough.
Steve, we look at the trade with the Coyotes that brought over Dylan Strome and Brendan Perlini, who's red hot right now. When you look at those two guys have been instrumental in the turnaround that you described, but I also look at Erik Gustafsson and I look at how he has had a breakthrough year. He's scoring, he's doing everything. He's always been the offensive-minded defenseman and taken some criticism for the way that he plays defense. But this year seems to be, he seems to be thriving in this new system. Maybe it's the new coach, maybe it's whatever, just a guy coming of age. But this looks like a guy who has come into his own since joining the first team power play, the first unit. How is he doing this, and why is it happening now?
Well, I think, aside from a goaltender, I think playing defense, breaking in as a defenseman in the NHL is one of the tougher things to do. There's just so many different, you know, skill sets that you have to have. And, you know, you're on offense, you're on defense. You make a mistake, as a defenseman, it's noticeable and it normally ends up in a good scoring chance. So, you know, I think with Gus, a couple things. And with Jeremy Collin behind the bench, you know, Gustafsson played, I think pretty much all last year down at the minors in Rockford. So he's got a coach who knows him really well. I think Jeremy really leaned on him with the Ice Hawks. So there's that familiarity, I think, which I think helps Gus more than anything. And then the other thing is he's got an unbelievable chemistry with Patrick Kane. And, you know, they're not out there all the time five-on-five together, but on the power play, and I know the power play hasn't scored in, you know, six or seven games, but on the power play, those two guys they're on the same wavelength, and they've really got it going. So, you know, that helps too. And I think the other thing that's maybe the most important and maybe the thing that Gustafsson is most proud of is the fact that, you know, he's playing better defensively now. And we pointed it out a couple of times in that Montreal game. He had a huge hip check early in the first period. You don't see those very often. That's an old-time term from the, you know, from back when I played. Stood a guy up right in the neutral ice area. So, you know, defensively, I think he's really taking a lot of pride. And, you know, he realizes that he's in a very unique situation where, hey, listen, I get to go on the ice on a power play. And those guys are typically out there almost a full 2 minutes. And I'm playing with Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews and Alex DeBrincat, maybe the finest second-year player right now in the NHL. You know, I don't want to let this slip through my fingers. So, you know, give him full marks. He is he's really come a long way, and it's tough to do. And like I said, there's just so many different areas of your game you have to be good as a defenseman. And he right now is just, you know, checking all those boxes.
They're just such an entertaining team to watch, too. I mean, there's so many attacking players. I get it that they need help on defense, and Crawford has to kind of stand on his head sometimes. But the Hawks are great value to watch because so many guys are having great years, even in a season where it might not end up in the playoffs.
Well, Molly, I'm with you on that. I mean, you know, it was a nail biter for them, but you know, the Toronto game, they're up 5-0 and they end up winning 5-4. It's an exciting hockey game, and they did it at home. They beat somebody 7-1, but they're putting up lots of goals. And you look at who's scoring the goals. This is what's impressive. You know, you got Patrick Kane, who's from Buffalo. You got Alex DeBrincat, who's from Detroit, and you've got Brandon Saad too, who is just having a great bounce back year. He's a Pittsburgh kid, so you know, I think three of your top four goal scorers are American-born kids, and I think that's that's great for the young hockey players here in the Chicagoland area, and it's good for the NHL too. But yeah, they're exciting. They're a lot of offense. Yeah, they're going to give up some chances, and they have done that. But when you've got a guy like Corey Crawford who helps shut the door most nights, you're going to come out of the winning end.
Steve, before we let you go, it was great to hear from Joel Quenneville yesterday in an interview with Dan Roan. I thought it was, Joel was as gracious and looked back at what happened with a lot of class and dignity, and nobody should be surprised by that. And I was critical of the time when the Hawks made the move and the timing of it and some of the other things that went into firing a guy who'd won three cups for this franchise. But if the Hawks get to the end of the season and they miss the playoffs because of the way they started, will they look at back with a sense of regret that they didn't make that move in the offseason, that they didn't do that in the summer when they probably could have started with a new coach and a fresh start and gotten off to a good start?
Well, I don't know about that, David. We started 6-2-2, so the start wasn't the problem. There was that little lull when we went out west, and they lost to Vancouver, they lost to Edmonton, they lost to Calgary. I think the Calgary game was the last game Joel had, so they were still above 500 at that time. So I'm certainly not going to put that on Joel. In fact, I played in that charity game yesterday afternoon that Joel was at. He was our coach, and Chris Chelios, Mary Beth Carlin, who kind of organized the whole thing, did a fantastic job. But, I had a chance to talk to him, and, he's in a good place right now, and he knows that he's going to end up in the NHL if he wants, and he'll have to pick of jobs, too. So
yep. It's
going to end up okay for him. As far as the Blackhawks go, they struggled, and they've struggled. They've had a couple of eight-game losing streaks, and one of them was under Jeremy Collin. But I think they're finally grasping the system, and they're embracing the system, and they've got belief in the system. So, it takes a little bit of time. So had the change happened in the offseason, I think it would have been better for all parties. But I'm certainly not going to, put the start on Joel because, as far as I was concerned, it was a pretty strong start.
Good stuff.
Thanks so much,
Thanks, Steve.
Take
care.
All right, boys. Anytime.
That's Steve Conroy. Joel said that when he exited other places, the bitterness and the animosity was at a different level, and that there's so many special things that happened here, so many good memories, and so many people that were so good to his family that it wasn't.
And he's
like
still
that.
A legend here.
He is.
And he's always going to be.
Oh, of course he is.
So that's a little different. And I just had to ask him because I think that's the way you look at it. Boy, if they get to this end of the year and they're
he's coaching a Blackhawk alumni game. What does that tell
Imagine
you?
That.
It just snorts and giggles. I mean, he's still very close to the franchise, and obviously he's still getting paid. All right, we're going to bring in Tim Brando next. We'll talk to him. He covered the he was doing games at the ACC tournament, so he knows a lot about the three of the number one seeds in this particular NCAA tournament. We'll ask him if that was right. And how good is Duke, and are they going to win this thing? Can Carolina make an impact? And, of course, Virginia, will they lose to a 16th seed? That's just mean-spirited. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 to the score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.